I'm Suzanne again, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Suzanne.
And thank you so much for the opportunity to come up here. My husband and I totally enjoyed the drive up this morning. What a beautiful day. And what a beautiful day to not wake up with a hangover, right? Be outside and see how gorgeous it is and breathe the fresh air. Seemingly, it felt like fresh air. So welcome to all the newcomers and all the visitors too. Glad we could all get together. My story really started at 21 years old as far as my alcoholic drinking. And at that point in my life, I had two small children. They were 2 and 3. And the man I was married to at the time was just convicted of first-degree murder and multiple armed robberies. So he was sentenced to life in prison. And I had to go back to my mom and dad's house. Live with mom and dad with my two little kids. Had left home, didn't finish high school, you know, wasn't really good employment opportunity for anybody. And so I had a lot of work to do to clean all that up. And I want to read something that aligns with where I was at, because the solution for me at that point in my life was less party. I had a lot of secrets. I never told anybody about my life with that man. I had lived under a fictitious name for 5 years with him, and my wreckage was to a degree that it felt overwhelming that it could ever be reconciled. And I didn't come to AA when I was 21. I found the bars when I was 21. And most every night, I'd put my kids to bed or ask my mom to put my kids to bed, and I'd be out. It wasn't until I was 26 years old I got my first drunk driving. And I was at a bar that was about 15 minutes from where I lived. And I don't know about you guys, but I'm a blackout drinker, and it happens a lot to me when I'm driving. And I remember distinctly this night thinking, when am I going to get home? When am I going to find the right way? And what was happening is I was in and out of a blackout, and I left the bar at closing, and at 3:30 in the morning, I got pulled over 90 miles away from my house. I kind of missed that target. And I don't remember most of that drive except for coming in and out going, when am I going to get home? I've got to get to bed. I've got to go to work. All I could think of was that CHP officer was a real schmuck. He didn't have anything better to do that night. And I didn't take any responsibility whatsoever for my drunken blackout state of driving that entire hour and a half in a blackout. And that was not the first time that that had happened. I drove in a blackout numerous times. That was the one time that I was arrested for it. So I had to go to AA. I had to get my court card signed. I had to hang out with a bunch of old people. I was 26 at the time, and everybody was old then. Today it's so different. There's so many young people who have the opportunity to recognize earlier that they have a problem with alcohol and that their life's unmanageable because of alcohol. And so I did my time according to the judge. I judged all of you, and I kept on drinking. And it wasn't until I was 31. So 21 to 31 is my 10 years of drinking and drugging and blacking out and living in a way that completely against what I believe was the woman that God made me to be. And I found a home group. It's a longer story how I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. That's 5 years later, but I was 31. And the home group was a book study. I was extremely rebellious. I didn't want to be an alcoholic. I couldn't believe that alcoholism was what my problem was. I thought I was crazy. I thought I just had been the victim of some terrible circumstances. And when I heard what alcoholism was, I was stunned to find out that I could relate, because when I wasn't drinking, I was thinking about drinking. I was planning my drinking. I was planning my babysitting. Everything. It was so obsessive for me. And once I had one, there was no telling how many drinks later, how many days later, what was going to happen. And so in this book study in my home group, this was in Cyprus down south, there was this paragraph that just struck me because it was hard. I mean, most of the pronouns in this word in this book is he. And a friend and I have been reading it lately together, and we say she because we want to feel like this is about us. And this is about women. And alcoholism, and it says, this is in this version, it's on page 33, to be gravely affected, one does not necessarily have to drink a long time, nor take the quantity some of us have. This is particularly true of women. Potential female alcoholics often turn into the real thing and are gone beyond recall in a few years. Certain drinkers who would be greatly insulted if called alcoholics are astonished at their inability to stop. We who are familiar with the symptoms see large numbers of potential alcoholics among young people everywhere, but try and get them to see it. And when I read that, I thought, that's me. It's only been 10 years, and I could not stop drinking. I had swore it off time and time again, and once I asked for help, my life changed tremendously. I didn't want to ask for a sponsor, but I knew I couldn't do this by myself. And I heard enough about it in meetings that I knew I needed to get help. And I thought, because I had memorized the steps, that that's what that was all about. Just be able to repeat what they say. And that wasn't what it was. Thank God for Alcoholics Anonymous, and that we have a solution to our alcoholism. My life has changed tremendously. All those secrets that I had at 21, I don't hold any of that baggage anymore. It is gone. I had two sponsors help me do a fourth and a fifth step, and to be able to help somebody about my moral inventory and my responsibility in that inventory was so liberating. And I think that time in my sobriety was the changing trajectory of my life. So that's probably my 10 minutes. Short story, but the bottom line is I'm so grateful to be part of Alcoholics Anonymous. My home group is Tuesday night in Visalia, the women's amity group, from 6:30 to 7:30 at Trinity Church. I know I've seen some of you there. I see some friends too from Visalia. There's also a Saturday morning meeting in Visalia, another church, Christ Lutheran, and that's from 9 to 10. And you know, for 5 years of my first 5 years of sobriety, I don't want anything to do with women's meetings. And today, I'm so thankful for the Women and Alcoholics Anonymous. I still appreciate all you guys because you got me through my first 5 years. I was very distracted at those open meetings, but it took me thank you guys for showing up today, and thanks for listening. Thank you to Bill, who on the way here said, "Will you be my 10 minutes speaker?" And I just want him to know how to say yes to me the next time. So, thank you. It is my pleasure to introduce our main speaker. And that is my husband, Bill Hatzman. Bill.
Hey.
Thank you, Suzanne, and thank you to Dusty for inviting me to come out and share some of my experience with you today. I'm an alcoholic, and he's Bill Hatzman.
Hey, Bill.
And today's kind of a special day for me. It's one day, 10 months, and 17 years since my last drink. I think that they should perhaps consider changing the name of this facility to the Memorial Bill Hatzman Sobriety Foundation. Let me start with something that's better than me. Heavenly Father, thank you for another day sober. Thank you for an opportunity to come and share what you've done in my life with people who have done the same or maybe looking, considering, maybe doing the same. I pray that my experience, my shortcomings, my successes, my failures might serve as an example of what's possible as a result of the process of going through the 12 steps in the AA program. I pray that you use me to serve you. Please show me, let me see, allow me to share, and to be a good steward with all of your blessings. And let's just wrap up there before I screw this up. Amen. So I'm going to do something silly. I've done this before, so many of you who I've known for many years know this gig, so just laugh along with that. You know, I'm going to update my Facebook. That was funny one time. You know, I resort to things like that because I have deep inside of me, like instinctually, right? I don't terribly suffer from it today, but there's a piece of me, like it's just a core of my fiber that is insecure, and that piece of me wants so desperately for you to like me. I suspect that you guys in this room might understand, but in the event that there's any lack of understanding, let me tell you the depths of that depravity. I'm so determined to get you to like me that, like, I want you to choose me if you have children over them. You know what I'm saying? I mean, that's how deep my insecurities can be. As a result of the things I hope to tell you about today, I don't suffer as much from those things. I still do choose to suffer from time to time, as much as I decide to do so. But I know today that there is a solution to those kinds of problems. I told you I was an alcoholic. I know there's a couple of people that are kind of newer to our fellowship here today. So for your benefit, I want to be sure to just tell you something that was really important for me, and that is that when I came here and there was a suggestion that I might be an alcoholic, I disputed it, much like Suzanne kind of talked about, you know. And I'll tell you largely why, is because when I look in the mirror, I don't see what I thought an alcoholic looked like. And maybe some of you can relate to this, but in my mind, there's a pretty solid image of what an alcoholic looks like, and he's typically kind of an older guy. He's usually scrawny. He's got disheveled hair and appearance. He's wearing a long coat even in the summer. He's in alleyways and park benches. He's asking you if he can bump some coins from you. He's got a paper sack in his pocket. You guys with me? I see some heads nodding. So when I look in the mirror, I don't see that image. And so to suggest that I'm an alcoholic really was a problem for me to digest. And I'm just so grateful that if there were people here in the rooms when I got here, and I thought it was so I don't know, it felt special to me to have Jean Marie be one of the readers today, because Jean Marie was one of the people, there were many of you, but she was one of the people that was in the rooms when I got it. And I also thought it was really cool that Ernesto got to read, because I hope in some small way I might be to him what people like Jean Marie were to me. And what people like Jean Marie were to me was patient and kind and tolerant. When I got here, like I said, I didn't have alcoholism. I had a bunch of people in my family and in the workplace that were just narrow-minded. They didn't understand that. They didn't understand what alcohol did for me. And I suspect many of you probably know what I'm talking about. You know, when I put alcohol in my system, well, you know, let's do this little kind of group exercise together. In a moment, I'm going to ask you to join me. I'm going to take a deep breath. I'm going to hold it for a moment, and then I'm going to let it out kind of slowly. So let's do that together. So tempted to say, here. How do you know what I'm talking about? Anyway, so I don't know if you felt that, but what happened to me there in a very small way was just some of the nerves just got a little calm. You know, a little smoothed over. A little bit of the tension of the day just kind of eked away a little bit. And when I take alcohol into my system, what happens is that happens on an order of magnitude. Like, all the people I've been dealing with that day, all the voices, and some, even some of my own, right? My own critical voices, they tend to just kind of wander into the wilderness and I start to think about how great I am. How smart I am, how tall I am, how good looking I am. Hey, you know what? I'm a good dancer. Let's just be clear, set the record straight. I am not a good dancer, but I have been under the illusion that I'm a good dancer, and that kind of goes into some of the things that happen as I continue to drink. So the first thing is I lose some of my inhibitions, my fears. I do and say things that I might otherwise be afraid to do. Makes me a real Casanova, right? Because frankly, I'm terrified to talk to girls, because what happens if they reject me? I'm afraid I'm just going to wither up and die right there on the spot, you know. And when I get some alcohol in my system, I become a social butterfly. And I can talk it up. And like I said, then I become a dancer. And then as I continue to drink, things that happen is I begin to lose motor control. And you guys know what this looks like, right? Like, have you ever been, I'm sure some of you in this room have joined me on this odyssey, but I've been driving, and I'm so drunk that I can drive, but I can't walk. Follow that? Yeah. And you don't find that out until you get out of the car. Or you try. And so I lose motor control and I'm completely unaware of it. And eventually what happens when I drink it up is I begin to violate my own value system. I do things that are not okay with me. I don't know, I'm always kind of sketchy about sharing with you the details of what that looks like, because I'm afraid you're going to judge me. But I also know the power of a specific example, and how important it was for me when you guys told me the truth about your situations, right? So I'll just give you a little glimmer. I remember one night I was out at a club. I was in the Army at the time, and we were going to a club where you'd pay a cover fee and then they let you drink all the beer you could drink. My kind of place, right? And I turned into a dancing superstar. I got up on the stage. They had a stage kind of like this one, right? And then on top of this stage, they had these big blocks. And they had to fit, and they were probably 2 foot tall. And then they had other 2 foot tall blocks on top of that. So I'm like, what is this? Maybe 3 foot tall from the floor, and then two. So what's that? 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. About 7 feet up in the air, and the song that's playing calls for a pirouette. And my mind and my body weren't in sync at the time. And what happened is I landed on the crowd below on the dance floor. And later that night, I came to. Driving, kind of like Suzanne talked, we're driving a long way from home. And next to me in the car was one of my fellow soldiers' wives. And, you know, I'm not here to tell you what your moral standing or values should be, but I'll tell you what mine are. That is not okay. That is not cool. And I don't want to be that guy. And you know what happens is when I wake up the next morning after a night like that, I don't know what to do with me. I feel so much remorse, so much shame. And frankly, I have fear about retribution, right? Which I should. And I don't know if you guys have found yourself in this position, but you know, when I wake up feeling like that, there's really only one thing that I can think of to do to make it better, and that's to start drinking again. And you know what I find myself doing is I start drinking to resolve problems that were caused by drinking. And that is a spiral staircase straight into hell. So, again, I don't have a drinking problem. I've got a problem with narrow-minded people around me. There was a progression of this, by the way. I think I've kind of painted that picture. But, you know, one of the other pictures I'll paint for you is, you know, early in my experimental days of drinking, I would find that friends would call me the next day and they'd say, "Dude, do you remember what you did?" Right? And I'd be kind of like, "Please tell me." And it would be funny, right? And then after a while, it was really not so funny. And then it was just outright shameful. And the friends that used to call and laugh with you are no longer calling. In fact, they're no longer inviting you to go to the party with them. And that's okay, because you know what? I didn't want to go with you anyway. Because you were going to go home earlier than I wanted to go home, and you weren't going to get your groove on like I was going to get my groove on. And so what I do, and I don't even see it, man, is I start like replacing those friends with new friends. And the new friends that I'm plugging into that spot are the people that want to stay as late as I want to stay, or later. And they're drinking as much as I'm drinking, or more. And you know, I look to my left and I look to my right and I think, hey, isn't this grand? I mean, if somebody has a problem, it's not me, because they're all doing the same thing or worse, right? And so I get this sense of, you know, self-security that I'm okay. And in May of 1998, I called a friend. Guy I went to high school with, played water polo with. In fact, he ended up marrying my sister. By this time, they had divorced, but he and I were still friends. I was kind of friends undercover, right? Because I knew it would hurt my sister to know that I still had a relationship with her ex-husband. But I mean, he and I like to get our groove on, right? So nothing wrong with that in my mind. And so I go out to, he's living in Lake Havasu, and I go out to see him, and our plan for the weekend is to get messed up, to have a good time. And on Friday night, we went out to the clubs, but for some reason, we practiced good judgment that night. We got a cab to take us to and from his house. The next day, however, we got up, and we drove to the grocery store, and we went in, and I can visually see that Albertsons and the parking lot. I can see the space where I parked. I mean, I remember this very vividly. We park and we start walking in, and the whole point is to get like a 30-pack or whatever of a beer. And I'm thinking to myself, this is a bad idea. And I don't know why, but I'm not going to change it. And we walk into the place and we get the beer, and we later go and we rent a boat. And the whole idea is we're going to go skiing and having a good time and chasing girls. And we do a lot of that during the day. And towards the end of the day, like 4 o'clock in the afternoon, when we've had way too much to drink, we decided it's a good idea to go ski on a river. Some of you that are skiing folks, you know that's really not ideal place to ski. We were too low. We didn't care. We're having fun. So I get out first, and I try to ski, and we're in swells. They're huge, and I can't get up. I get dragged around. I'm drinking half the river. And so my friend gets in, and we take off, and he gets up. And there's a part of me that's kind of envious. You know, he did better than me. And he eventually falls, and so I come around in the boat to come pick him up, and I get this idea. I don't know if you've ever had a great idea. I had this great idea. It was going to be swell. I was going to come by, and at the last minute, I was going to turn in front of him and throw this weight of water at him to kind of, you know, go, "Neater, neater, you know, because you did better than me." And as I turned that corner, there was a there was a really solid lump in my stomach. And I didn't know what happened exactly, but it felt like something not good happened. And I turn around and I see my friend in the water. And I noticed that the water around him is a little different color than the rest of the water. And as I get closer to him, I can see that it's changing rapidly. There's a lot of blood in the water. And To this day, I still do not have the foggiest idea how I got the back of that boat close enough to him to pull him up on the boat. But I will never forget what I saw when I did. The propeller made three lacerations. Thank God, they were on his buttocks and the top of his leg. And he had three lacerations, and one of them stretched all the way across from the middle of his backside to his side. And out of that gash, I could see his hip bone. And there was a lot of blood. And he was still conscious at the moment. We got him down on the floor. I took this little tank top thing that I had on and tried to compress the wounds, which wasn't working terribly well. And I drove as fast as I could back to the marina. This is that you can be drunk enough to drive but not walk situation. I went to get out of the boat and my legs didn't cooperate. And so I really, literally did a low crawl into the marina, shouting as loud as I could, call 911, call 911. And a few minutes later, the ambulance arrived and they took my friend to the hospital, and then the sheriffs arrived. And they picked me up and they took me to the jail. And I was pretty polluted. I was very afraid for what was going to happen to me and my friend. Can you feel that? Yeah. I'm not proud of that. But I think it's important to be honest with you. My chief fear was what was going to happen to me when my friend's very life was in the balance. So they put me in a cell after they booked me, and I don't know, I woke up the next morning, and I don't know what's going on. They put me in this other cell with this other guy, and I'm just like all day stewing about what's going to happen. And it was the weirdest thing, because it was a 3-day weekend, and so on the holiday, on the Monday that was a holiday, for some reason the judge came in and saw me. He probably saw other people too. And I can only surmise that he saw the genuine disgust with myself in me, that he showed me a tremendous amount of pity and empathy and grace, and he sentenced me to one more night in jail, a $600 fine. I had to take a boat safety class, and I was ordered to pay his hospital expenses or his medical expenses, and then I drove home. My friend stayed in the hospital. He stayed in that hospital for months. He did survive. I'm often reminded to tell you that part because sometimes I forget to mention it. My friend did survive, and you know, just to show you the depth of my depravity, it was about 12 months later when I received another envelope with receipts in it for various medical supplies that he needed for his wounds still, and I remember feeling resentful. I remember thinking, God, he's going to milk me out of everything I have. I hope you really understand what a depraved person you have talking to you today. So that was in 1998. In February of 2004, which was, 6 years later, I was awakened in my house. I can assure you, by the way, that in those six or so years, it did not get better. I was awakened in my house early in the morning. I woke up and saw my girlfriend, and then I saw my mom, and I thought, that's a weird combination. And then my sisters were there, and then they said they were there to surprise me. And I had always dreamed of having a surprise party. I had in mind, you know, the kind with the bounce house and the ponies, but it's not the kind of surprise party I got. by your laughter, I said, you know, I was intervention. That's exactly what it was. And I had had many some friends from high school, some my sisters, their spouses, my mom, my dad, and then some strange guy that I know now by the name Grass. But they were in my living room, and they had these pieces of paper, and you know the routine, right? So they're telling me about some of the good times, and then they're telling me about some of the not so good times, and then they all end their letter with, "Please accept our offer of help today." And I was broken. I had been on a merry-go-round that I didn't know how to go get off of. I was practicing a very poor long-term financial plan. It's called spending more than you're making. I don't recommend it. I was doing that to keep the party going. It was a party of one by that time, They caught me at just the right time, and so I went to a treatment center up in a little north of here. Any change in echoes, the love in the house? No? I find one. For 30 days, there were some kind people who tried to present the truth to me, and I couldn't have it. What happened for me is while I was in treatment, I talked the girl that I was dating at the time into mailing the prescription for Vicodin to me in treatment. You can imagine the counselors were delighted to see my girlfriend mailing me drugs. And so what they did, because at that time anyway, the law required them to follow the doctor's directions, they handed it out the way it was prescribed. And maybe you guys have had this experience where they say one or two every 4 to 6 hours. And, you know, the way I read that is six every hour. It's not the way they read it. And they just kind of pissed me off by giving me one at a time every once in a while. And they told me that what I was doing was keeping the demon alive. And I didn't believe them. And so the day that I was released from treatment, they wrapped what was left of that prescription bottle in with some other things and kind of tucked it underneath a bag in the back of my car, thinking I didn't see it or know how to get to it, thinking that maybe my sister would be wise to the routine. I said to my sister something like, "Hey, look at that over there." And then I had taken like four times the prescribed amount without water in the parking lot. So, look, I'm not here to tell you what sobriety means to you, but I'll tell you, for me, I left treatment not sober. And what happened is I got home and I finished that supply and then I got thirsty. And I went and got some beer. And for the next year and a couple months, I would go to AA meetings because, I mean, by now the gig's up, right? If they kill you, the surprise party. Everybody knows, right? So there's no casual way to like have a beer at mom's house. And so what I'm doing is I'm trying to time my drinking around my interactions with my family. Anybody ever try to time your drinking? And a couple of you? I never could figure it out, man. I always end up drunk at the wrong time. And busted, you know. And so I was going to these AA meetings to try to, you know, fool my family into thinking that something good was happening in my life. I would come to the meetings and I would hear people talk about their drinking and their behavior. And oftentimes I would think, yeah, you know, that sounds eerily familiar. But then inevitably they would talk about doing this step thing with this sponsored person and I thought, how sad for you. How tragic that your life has fallen to that degree. I, however, possess a superior intellect and I'm going to be able to figure this thing out. And those of you who are laughing know that I figured it out, all right? About a year and a couple months after getting home from that treatment center, I found myself loaded again, and I couldn't figure it out. And I thank God, I found myself desperate. And I went. Here's what happened: is I had a medical procedure. It was a dental thing, and I was afraid it might hurt, and so I asked the doctor to prescribe pain medication, even though I knew very clearly that that's not safe for me. And again, by the way, I'm not offering you any advice about your situation. I'm just telling you about me, okay? So let's not get mixed up about that. for me, that was not a safe thing. It always led to drinking. And so what I did was, see, I got a plan. I'm going to have the doctor write the script so that if I need it, my sponsor can dispense it to me safely and we'll be okay. And I don't want to get too more into the politics of that. So what happened was the sponsor, his daughter had a baby like the night before the procedure, and so, you know, being the generous kind soul that I am, I released him from the responsibility for watching me that day, and I went over to my grandma's house. And I don't know about you guys, but my grandma's an easy, I can shake her easy, right? So I didn't know the difference. I didn't know there was so much similarity between a doctor-administered medication and the stuff I like to drink and otherwise. And so what happened is I came out of the anesthesia incredibly thirsty. And so I went to the pharmacy to pick up the antiseptic rinse that I needed. And I was there. There was no reason to make an extra trip. I went ahead and picked up the pain medication, and I took that more than was prescribed, again, by mouth, without any, while I'm in the store. I didn't even get out of the store before I got it down my throat, and it occurred to me that I wasn't very far from the beer aisle, and I picked up a case of my favorite beer, and I went home, and the rest of that weekend, I used all the stuff that I had. I woke up on Monday morning. Apparently, I had forgotten to tell my alarm clock that I had resigned from AA. Sobriety was not important to me anymore. And my alarm clock went off. And now, I need to probably also tell you that by that date, I had 128 days without a drink. And I like to think I was keeping me sober. Well, in fact, the truth is, I was keeping me sober, largely on the fear about what would happen if I drank again. And what I have found for me is that 128 days is my best. I haven't been able to beat that on my own. I don't have whatever it is that it takes, power, influence, intellect, whatever. I don't have it. And so I wake up that morning and I forgot that I resigned, and so I got my car and I drove to the Alano Pub, which is something I've been doing every day for 128 days. And on my drive to the Alano Pub, you know those aprons they put on you at the dentist when they take your x-rays and your teeth, those heavy blankets? I felt like 100 of them on me. I was having a hard time breathing, carrying the weight of that lie. Because, see, I was 2 weeks away from a 5-month chip. If I got, I'm going to get that 5-month chip, whether I deserved it or not. And I get to the meeting, and they ask me to read the daily reflection to start the meeting off. And by the time I'm done, I'm crying in front of a bunch of strangers. And I don't know how you guys like to start your Monday mornings, but that is not my idea of a good Monday. And I told them, I said, I drank again, man. I can't figure this thing out. And there was a guy in the back, guy named Jeremy. And Jeremy said, hey, man, why don't you call your sponsor? And I thought that was a really unnecessary step. And I already knew I was a loser. I didn't need somebody else to reaffirm that in my mind. But for some reason, I was just willing enough to take that advice that I called him. And some of you may remember Paul and Shelley that were from Isaiah. Paul was my sponsor at the time. And I called Paul. And do you know, he wasn't even surprised. Kind of hurts my feelings when I think about it. Right? No, Paul wasn't surprised because 128 days before that, he had asked me to do two simple things. He'd asked me to read a few pages of our book, and he asked me to answer two questions for me. Maybe you guys have answered these questions. You know, what does it look like for Bill? What evidence does Bill have that he's powerless over alcohol? What evidence does Bill have that his life is unmanageable? Those are the two questions he gave you. They're not terribly complex assignments. I was busy. For the record, I was unemployed, and I was busy. And I've met few people who are busier than unemployed newcomers in AA. That's just my experience. But in any case, I told Paul that morning, I said, you know what, I will do anything to live sober. And he said, well, you're going to have to show me. And I said, sure, man, anything. What are you going to do? And he said, well, why don't we start with, you know, that simple assignment that I gave you 128 days ago, right? And he asked me also to make a commitment. He asked me to commit to spending at least 5 minutes every night or every sometime during the day with a pencil in my hand and a piece of paper. And I was to either write the answer to the question or if I finished that, to write whatever was going on that day. Something I now know we call journaling. And I don't know why, but I was willing to do that. And I'll tell you, much of my motivation at that time was not to get lip sober. It just wasn't, man. You know, the truth of the matter is, I was willing to do that because I wanted to prove it wrong. I wanted to prove that your stupid little thing, I didn't need. And I didn't miss a single day until I remember I missed a day, and I mean, still kind of upset about it, but I missed a day around month 10. And by that time, Paul had gotten me through the ninth step. I was still making amends. I'm still making amends. My life had changed in such profound ways that it removed any doubt in my mind that this would work for me. So over the next couple of months, I got to my anniversary, my first year anniversary, and by that time I had just finished my 12-step assignment. And by the way, I'm not offering any kind of commentary on how long it should take you to go through the 12 steps. Some people will work through them much faster, some people might take longer. I will tell you that for me, it seemed to be the perfect amount of time, because the time that I spent in each one of those steps allowed me to get pretty deep into them. So by the time I got to the first year, I finished the 12 steps. Shortly after that, my sponsor, Paul, moved out of town. I started to feel a little randy, you know, a little unsupervised. You know what that looks like? And I think about it today. Our book says that, that the important thing for us to do is to maintain a spiritual wellness, right? I know I didn't say that quite right, but the meaning is correct. That it's critically important that I maintain a spiritual fitness. So, my question has been, how do you know you're spiritually fit? I mean, how do you measure that? You don't take a temperature, right? And what I've found is that it's a lot easier to measure a lack of spiritual fitness than it is to measure spiritual fitness. And what a lack of spiritual fitness looks like to me is I start to get sort of agitated. Like, people are never driving the right speed. They're either too fast or too slow. The lights are never turning when I think they ought to. My boss never appreciates the work I'm doing, and is always asking me to do unreasonable things. You get that, right? I noticed myself in a meeting. Some of you may remember a guy by the name of Gary Toon. Gary was a great long-term sober member of AA. He passed not so long ago, but Gary was a salty old sailor, and I'm an Army veteran, and at one of the meetings, there was something about the Army that came out, and Gary, in his good-natured, if you knew Gary, Gary made a wise comment about the Army, you know, being somehow inferior to the Navy, and I found myself, like, engaging in argument with him in a meeting. That's a real good sign of a lack of spiritual wellness, right? So I think what happened is I called Paul to tell on Gary. So Gary needed to be sanctioned. Inappropriate the way he was behaving. And Paul saw it for exactly what it was. It was my problem. And he suggested that since he was no longer there in the site area, that it might be a good idea for me to get a local sponsor. And I searched around for a little while, and I found one. And a guy by the name of Kenny Holcomb took me through the 12 steps. Some of you may remember Kenny, a great AA member. I got through the steps with Kenny, and that didn't take quite a year, but it took several months. And after that, I got connected with a guy named Jim Schaefers. Some of you guys may remember Jim Schaefers. He managed the Alarm Club in Vicente for a short time. He was his sponsor was Clancy, you know, the almighty Clancy from Los Angeles. Great, great AA member. After I worked with him, I think Rick Evans I don't remember the order exactly, but I'm working with a guy named Bobby D today, and what I've done is I've continued to stay in the process of discovery and recovery, and it's helped me in some pretty tremendous ways. I guess I've talked a lot about what it was like, and I've told you something about what happened. So what's my life like today? It's pretty good. It really is. Actually, at the end of this month, I will have been married successfully and happy about it for 14 years. There's a lot of you that have been married a lot longer than that. And so that may not seem all that impressive, but, you know, I was never the kind of guy that could stay in a relationship. Most of that routine was where she would start noticing my drinking, and then it was time to get a new sheet. Because I'm not going to have anybody tell me what to do. God bless me with Suzanne. She's far wiser and smarter, and she's all the good things more than me. I'm so lucky to be able to share a life with her. I want to tell you a little bit about some of the amends process that I've been through. And let me go back to my friend Gavin, the guy I hit with the boat. I got to the 4-year mark of sobriety, and I knew I needed to make amends with him, but I didn't know where to find him. And somehow, some combination of mutual friends, I found out how to get a hold of him, and I made an appointment with him. I was going to meet up with him in April, must have been around 2009, I think. And on the morning I was supposed to meet up with him, he called and said, "Hey, I'm with my family, we're playing golf, it's a holiday weekend, I'm not going to be able to meet with you." And I said, "Okay, well, let's get together another time." And that time never came up, and it still hasn't come up. And for years, as I went, I told you I worked the steps with other guys, I would continue to revisit that amends that I felt like I needed to get free. And you know, if you study the book, there's some things that I've seen in it that talk about that the amends is not something that people I've harmed owe me. Right? And so I need to be really clear about my role here. And my current sponsor, when I got to him, I think it was the 9th year or so, we were talking about this, and I told him about all the ways that I was trying to get a hold of him through social media, and actually he worked for an organization that was a customer of mine, and so I was asking him if he thought it was okay if I called the HR people at that company to get his yeah. See, and so my sponsor told me it is not cool to stalk someone. And he said, you know, you need to really pay attention to something. He's made it through his actions of not getting in talk with you, in contact with you. He's made it very clear that he does not want to be in contact with you. And I was like, oh shit, I didn't see that. And so I stopped stalking my friend Gavin. And a couple of years after that, we're going through the work again. And it occurs to me for the first time that there were other people that I harmed in that act. And here's how it occurred to me. I went to breakfast on a Sunday morning, and his family walked into the restaurant. And I got that ball. Remember I told you about that ball in my stomach, nervous? And I'm thinking about how much they must hate me for what I've done to their family. And I'm afraid. And so I talked to my sponsor about that, and he said, "Well, maybe we need to change the focus." And so he helped me to write out some things. And I, you know, there's a guy who says, you know how to tell when somebody's working on their ninth step, right? There's this funny noise you'll hear. It sounds like this, right? You're knocking on doors or making phone calls to set appointments. And so my friend Gavin has a mother who had always been... I think Mother Bear is probably a fair way to describe it. I think you'll get the image right. She's always very, very protective of her family. And in a good way, right? But I was afraid of her, man, because I was afraid she was going to tell me what I'm sure she thought about me and what I had done to her family. I mean, it was bad enough that my sister divorced right? But now then I had to come back afterwards and physically harm him. And so I pick up the phone and I call, and I'm hoping that his dad answers, because he was a sweetheart. And you know who answered, right? His mom. And I tell her, hey, this is Bill Hasselman calling. And you can imagine the pregnant pause. She's thinking, why is this guy calling me? Right? I mean, it's out of place. And I said, this call is long overdue. I did some real harm to you and your family, and I'm calling to try to set that right. And I got a chance to talk to her about how I understood what I did to her. See, she got a phone call on the afternoon, Saturday. She was told by some hospital staff that her son was being rushed into emergency surgery, and that was really all they could tell her. And for the next 6 hours, she drove across the desert to arrive at a hospital, not knowing what she was going to find. I did that to her. And I got a chance, to own that. And I thought for sure she was going to say some nasty things, and you know what she said? She said, oh honey, we all make mistakes. I did not see that coming. And I said, I guess out of reflex and out of nervousness, I said, well, maybe, but that was a pretty big one. And she said, well, I'll give you that. And I said, I think it might be important for me to tell you that I'm calling because I want to find a way to get this right with you and your family. And I said, and I know one part of what I'm doing today doesn't necessarily directly affect you, but you might be interested to know that I have the privilege of taking AA meetings into the prisons locally. So I get to serve at Avenel and the two prisons in Corcoran. And in fact, today I'm the coordinator for those facilities. So if you don't want to be lassoed into that work, you might leave promptly, and I'm going to see you, because I was probably asking to run that. Anyway, so I got to tell her that, so God has this amazing way of coordinating coincidences, right? I mean, I know that today to be spiritual experiences or awakenings, but one of the funny little coincidences that happened is just before this call took place, I met a guy in prison because he was driving a boat and someone lost his life. Because he was drunk. And I didn't miss the possibility that I could have been the one in that cell. This guy's doing a life sentence. I could be doing a life sentence. If it wasn't for seconds and inches, right? I mean, how do you hit somebody in just a way that really hurts them bad but doesn't kill them? I don't know how to do that. Obviously, because I wasn't trying to hit him in the first place. But I got to tell her about how I met a guy who wasn't as fortunate as her son and I. And I got to tell her that that you guys have put me in a position to try to help other people who have been living the same way that I was living the day that I did that to her family. And then I said to her, I said, it's kind of funny. Another side story. So his brother, Suzanne and I got married right around the same time frame, and after we got married, I moved into her home. The decorations were a lot nicer. And driving from like the main street to her home, our home, I had to go past his brother's house. And I would drive past, this was before that made him in, I would drive past his house, and sometimes he'd be outside, and every time I'd kind of go like this, I don't want him to see me, right? And so I mentioned to her that I felt like I really wanted to find a way to make it right with her son. And obviously I was continuing to carry the shame and guilt of what I had done. And she said, I can tell you, okay, I can solve this mystery for you. Because like I said, I could never reach him, and if you want, give him my number. And she said, here's the thing, man, he's remarried and he's got a family. And she said, I'm certain that out of respect for his current wife, he is avoiding conversations with his ex-wife's brother. Oh my God. Like, it's so clear now. Like, of course, that makes all the sense in the world. He doesn't hate me. He loves his wife. And I got free that day, man. I haven't had to cower in the presence of that family since that day. And there's a few other stories. I think I still have a few minutes. I'll tell you a few more stories. So when I was here among you, but not among you, you know, when your little program of recovery was so sad for you, but I don't have to do that. So I was drinking and going to meetings, you know, that had to change. My grandmother began to feel threatened because things in her home were starting to disappear. And one of the things that disappeared from her home that pushed us over the falls was some medication that she took for her heart. And she, there was one prime suspect. He's up here on stage, guys. And so what I forced my grandmother to do because of my behavior was I forced my grandmother to call her daughter and tell her that I was no longer welcome at grandma's house. So I got banned from grandma's house. And this is the same grandmother, by the way, who along with my mother would go to AA meetings with me. I think they were just trying to make sure I went in the door and stayed, right? That's how much they love me, and I know that I broke their hearts with my behavior. Now, just for the record, I didn't take the heart medication, but I did a lot of other shit I should have taken. And so when I started to get, and this, by the way, when my mom made the call to tell me about this, was in my current streak of sobriety. And so, you know, everything in me wanted to shout out, but I didn't do it. And somehow I restrained that, and I said, you know what, Mom? I'm sorry that my behavior has put you in this position, and I'm going to honor that request that I not go to my house. And it broke my heart. I'm the first grandchild of the generation, and while my cousins may tell you otherwise, I've clearly always been her favorite. And it broke my heart to be banned from grandma's house. But that's how my current streak of sobriety started. And, you know, that same grandmother was one of the first to welcome me back. And when she did, again, coincidentally, shortly after I was invited to come back to my grandmother's house, she had an incident that caused the DMV to revoke her license, so she no longer could drive. And so I got to be her lifeline to the grocery store. Every Saturday morning for a little over 5 years, I got to take my grandmother to the grocery store. And I'll tell you that while I was doing that, I felt supremely inconvenienced. And I'm so glad that I did it. At the end of that 5-year streak, what happened was my grandmother's mental cognition had to deteriorated to a point where she had to be put into a facility, and for the next almost 5 years, I could go on Saturdays to visit with her, and I was one of the few faces that she saw regularly, and she passed shortly after that, and I got an opportunity to my mom question her judgment sometimes. I've got some perfectly capable siblings in my family, and my mom decided to ask me to say to do the eulogy at my grandmother's funeral, and it meant so much to me to be able to do that, and I got to tell some fun stories about my grandmother and some of the pranks she pulled on me, and after the eulogy, I walked down, but they had an open casket, and I took a guy that I was sponsoring at the time. Some of you may have met Phil. I took Phil with me. Because, you know, things like that are, man, that's touchy, you know, emotional. That can be a dangerous place to be, man. You know, it's overly joyful and overly sad, right? Or places that a drink can start to look like a good solution. And so I took my friend Phil with me to the funeral. And Phil was sitting in the pews there. And I came by my grandmother's casket. And I got to take my 10-year chip and put it in her hands. And then I sat down, and I sat down next to Phil, and he gives me this elbow, and he says, "Dude, what are you doing? You're not supposed to touch the button." And I said, "Dude, I put my 10-year chip in her hands." And he goes, "You know what? If they ever dig her up, they're going to think she was only 10 years sober." Where do you get stuff like that? think I still have a little time. One more story?
Yeah, sure.
Okay. So this one's a little more involved, but I'll not belabor it. One of the relationships I had a tremendous amount of trouble with was my father. And when I was up at treatment, there was one of the modalities of treatment that they had us do was gazing into a fellow patient's eyes, and I don't remember how they did it. They were talking to us and all that stuff, and we were supposed to like be recalling things from the past, and one of the things that came to my mind was some violence between my father and I when I was a child. And I guess I had repressed those memories, and they came up, and I got really, I mean, to say angry is to not fully express how upset I was with my father. And I was so upset I really wanted to get even. And so when I came home, I was struggling with this desire to get even and also this desire to not do something that I would regret and have to make amends for. And so what I decided was the same thing to do was just to exclude my father from my life altogether. And so I stayed away from my dad for almost 2 years. Now, if you follow the timeline, there was about a year and a couple months that I was still going in and out of sobriety, right? I really wasn't sober. And then there was another year that took me to work my first set of 12 steps. And so, it sounds easy enough to not be part of somebody's life for 2 years, but if you start thinking about this as like two birthdays, two Christmases, two Easter, two Thanksgivings, things that are all family stuff. It's a big deal. But I was afraid. I was afraid of what my dad might say, or what I might say, or what he might do, or what I might do. And the safest thing to my sobriety felt like I just needed to keep him away. And one of the exercises that my sponsor had me do was the sex inventory in the fourth step. And he had me take a derivative of the work there where I was asked to define my ideal relationship with a significant other. But in this case, he asked me to define the ideal relationship with a son. And I don't have my own children, so he said, if you had a son, what would that relationship look like? What would you want it to look like? And you know, I didn't see what he was doing. And this looked like a really easy assignment for me because I knew what that relationship should look like. Out of all the fantasies in my head, if I had a son, I'd want to be a part of his life. I'd want him to come to me for anything, for help, for advice. I'd want to be involved, man. I'd want to see him regularly. I would want to be there on all the important days in his life. I'd want to be there when his heart was broken. I'd want to be there when he got the job or the promotion. I'd want to be there on his wedding day. I'd want to be there. I just want to be there. And my sponsor did a sponsor thing. Some of you who have sponsors have been through this process, you know where I'm going. And where my sponsor went with that is, how are you doing at the next step? And I was failing miserably. I was afraid. And I had the benefit of also a mental health professional. I was seeing a therapist around the same time, and I was working with her. And I had gone to therapists before with the HERS before, right? The couples counseling and all that. And as soon as my drinking became part of the equation, then that relationship was over. In this case, and by the way, back in those days, I would always suppress my drinking. I never wanted to tell the truth, and I'd spend the 50 minutes or whatever with the therapist and then spend the rest of my life doing what I wanted to do. In this case, I went and asked for homework, and the therapist was happy to give me homework, and I was happy to do the homework, and what happened is I began to think about what a healthy relationship with my father could look like. And what I started with was something that felt safe. I started having lunch with my dad. And that seemed safe because it was in a public place and it had a start and stop time that everybody seemed to kind of understand. And so we started to meet, and my sponsor inquired how that was going, and he started asking me about the specific steps of how that was going. And I said, well, I called my dad and I'd say, hey, meet you in and out at 11:30 or whatever. And he said, how did that conversation end? And I'd say, see you later. And he asked me, he said, is that how those conversations are supposed to end? And I knew it wasn't. But see, I was angry and I was afraid. I did not feel like I loved my dad. I was not about to say I love you. On the principle of honesty, I am not going to lie. And my sponsor did not tell me what to do. What he did was he encouraged me to do what I knew was the right thing to do. He encouraged me consistently to learn how to live according to my value system, not somebody else's. And so I called my dad next, and I told him where we were going to meet and what time, and then I said, okay, Dad, love you. And I caught him off guard. And he didn't know how to respond, and the phone line went dead. In fact, I don't even know if he heard me. I mean, when I think about it now, I'm not even certain. See, there had been 2 years there with no contact. And I want to throw a love you at him. Of course he couldn't have predicted that. Well, that's not how I interpreted the experience. The way I interpreted it was, yes, I won. I went back to tell my sponsor about how I won, and now I don't have to do that anymore. And he reminded me that this principle, you know, we don't stop doing the right thing because we don't get the expected results. Damn it. So I continued, and my dad began to say, look to, and then there was that day when he said it first. And you know, up until that moment, I would have bet you money that I will never, that I don't need my dad in my life. I don't need his approval, his affection, and I certainly don't need his love. And that day I found out I was wrong. And, you know, there's some more cosmic coincidence. Right about the same time, or shortly thereafter, I'm getting things out of order. So the next thing that happened is about 6 weeks after that, maybe 8 weeks, within a 6 to 8 week time frame, my dad had a stroke. And to this day, he struggles to speak. I haven't missed the fact that I came within 6 weeks of knowing that truth. I could have missed it. Because of my pride and my fear. And I'm so grateful that I have other men in recovery around me. I have a men's group that I participate in on Saturday mornings. And I remember along the process, my dad invited me to go with him to a Fresno State football game. And we had done that before, and I was always getting blotto loaded at the games, right? And so I was afraid that maybe that wasn't a safe place for me to go, a safe person to go with. And so I told the group of men in my group that I had declined the offer, but I was having second thoughts, and maybe the next time he asks me, I'll accept his invitation. And one of the guys there said, hey, jackass, why don't you buy the tickets? Man, telling you guys nothing. another guy named Larry said to me with tears in his eyes, he said, don't miss the opportunity to restore the relationship with your father. And he told me that because he had missed his. And he saw in me that I had an opportunity not to have the same regret that he had. And he was bold enough to tell me the truth. I do not deserve the life that I have today, man, but God, I'm so glad to have it. My life has been profoundly improved as a result of getting a sponsor and going through the 12 steps and facing my fears and telling the truth. And crying in front of strangers. I'll do this every day of my life, and this is what it takes. I am so blessed. I want to thank you for the life that I have today. If I didn't say anything that resonated with you, I want to thank you for being polite. You've been a very hospitable crowd. You've made me feel like I'm being the guy today that I'm meant to be. And that's the greatest thing I could realize, is just to be the guy that I was meant to be. And I fall short every day, I know, but I keep trying. Thank you very much.